Neil Slade with us. Tickle Your Amygdala. We're going to come back in a moment and take your calls, chat with Neil more about the brain in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie back with you along with Neil Slade. Neil, let's go back to that story about the pet that passed on.
Sure.
And it's a great story. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I've got another quick story after that, so don't let
me
forget that.
I won't.
Anyway, my wife had a number of precognitive dreams, and it turns out she predicted the day they were born to the date and how many dogs were in the litter. And they both came true. And when we got the dogs, without any coaching on our parts whatsoever, they exhibited the same behaviors and habits as they had in their previous lifetime. And that meant going to their own particular chair that they adopted in the previous life. They both went to the same chair. One of the dogs always slept next to my head in the bed. The same dog did the same thing again. So we're utterly convinced that they came back again. And what this woman guru said, that your pets will come back. And she also said something, was that animals don't reincarnate into people as a rule. Animals stay animals in their reincarnation. And though your pets will be your companions on this plane and in the next. So I thought that was a pretty interesting experience for us to have our pets come back to us.
It really is. And how about the other story?
The other thing was perhaps even more incredible. This was years ago. My father had died a year previous, and it was my birthday. And I had an answering machine, and all the messages were kept on one side of the tape. But on my birthday, for some reason, for some unknown reason, I decided it was time to flip the tape over and use the other side of the tape. And I'm going to play for you the message that I heard when I flipped the tape over on my birthday.
All right. Goes, okay.
Happy birthday, son.
Who was that? Who was that?
That was my father wishing me a happy birthday on my birthday.
How did that happen?
You tell me. You tell me.
Was somebody playing the gag on you?
No, that was my... Oh, that was... without any question, that was my father wishing me a happy birthday. Now, I'm not claiming... It may have been that he had recorded the message in years previous and I had forgotten about it.
All right.
For some reason, I decided, without any conscious knowledge of it, I decided, well, it's time to flip the tape over on that day. And there was his voice. Isn't that interesting?
Synchronicity is amazing, isn't it?
So I mean, you know, I mean, we very continually have evidence that somebody is watching us and looking out for us in ways that are unexpected. I'll give you another very interesting story, and this has to do with music. I kept the very first record that my mother bought for me as a five-year-old child from 1959.
What was the name of the song?
The name of the record was Once Upon an Orchestra. And it was a wonderful record, and I just loved it. And it was a story in music narrated by the actor David Wayne. And it was the very first record that I had. And I kept the record for 50 years, and this was about 10, maybe 15 years ago. And the record had gotten, it was still in reasonably good condition, but it was got a little bit dusty.
Oh, were they little 45s?
No, this was an LP. It was 15 minutes.
Oh, a big one. Okay.
It was a big record. And one day I decided it needed to be cleaned, so I got some cleaning solvent.
Uh-oh.
And I decided to clean the record. Well, you know what happened, don't you?
Yeah.
I melted all
You
the
melted it.
Record,
you scratched it. Yeah.
And I was devastated. Here, I was clicked into my reptile brain. I wasn't using my frontal lobes. And I cleaned the record, and I was devastated because I absolutely loved the record, and it was a wonderful record. So I went online. This is when you could, this was not that long ago that, you know, you could still do searches on the Internet and stuff. So I searched on the Internet for 2 months, seeing if any record store or eBay or any individual had a copy of the record. Nobody had the record. Nobody had even heard of the record. So I decided, well, okay, let's write to David Wayne, the narrator, who's by then either dead or very old.
Or like 90 years old.
I got the address of his estate, and I wrote to them, but I never heard from them. Now, so after about 2 months of searching, I finally gave up, and I was very, very sad. Well, something happened one day, and I went into a record store 5 minutes from my house, and something told me to look in the children's record section. And sure enough, what do you think I found in that record bin?
There it was.
There it was, in mint condition for $2.50.
No.
Mint.
That's the miracle, the price.
It was absolutely a miracle. Now, what made me go to that record store? And this is a record store that I generally never went into. But something or somebody, some spirit, maybe it was brain radar intuition, maybe it was an angel looking after me, maybe it was the spirit of the composer who composed the thing, had me go to that store and after 2 months look in that record bin, and for of all things, 5 minutes from my house, down that record. And as a matter of fact, I put it up on YouTube, so if people want to listen to Once Upon an Orchestra, they can actually hear that record of mine that's long been out of copyright.
You sound like you've expanded your work on brain power, because you sound like you're more metaphysical than you've been.
Well, I think I've been that way for a long time, but what's happened over the years is I've collected more and more experiences that support the idea of metaphysical reality and life after death and paranormal. You know, we did that television show in Boulder.
Yep.
And remember when I whipped out that list of paranormal scientific control experiments? People say, well, there's no proof for, some people say, the skeptics. You know, what is a skeptic except somebody who automatically takes the negative view of something without having all of the information?
He was told no as a baby.
Yes, exactly right. Uh-huh. And so, you know, I rolled out that list, and what was it, 20 feet long of all the scientific references. So I've just collected all of these experiences, and I could talk for hours. The flying broom that we had in my living room, we've talked about, the broom that would launch itself off the wall by itself from time to time. All kinds of things. So as I've grown older, I've just kind of more tuned into the reality of such things.
Do you think telepathy, Neil, is within the brain or outside of the brain?
I think the brain is a television and radio receiver. It receives information. And I think our consciousness is a combination of both what we are experiencing through our senses and through our logic and through our thinking brain, but that's not all of it. That's just the receiver for the universe at large. And we know from all of the accounts of near-death experiences that are impossible to explain without such a thing being real, that there is consciousness that exists outside of the brain itself.
Let's take some calls for you. Carlos in San Francisco, get us started here. Carlos, go ahead.
Good evening, good morning, to George and
hi, Carlos.
Slade. I tried to call on your 19th anniversary, and I just wanted to congratulate you, George.
Thank you.
You're a milestone. And I just want to say that I really appreciate your style and your diversity of content, but equally important, I appreciate the callers.
Me too.
So,
me too.
That having been said, I'd like to preface my question very quickly here. You mentioned Rain Man, and one of the characters that was patterned after by Dustin Hoffman was the late Kim Peake, and his memory specifically referred to calendaring, so he could calendar including the leap year. So if you had a day that fell on 1 year at a particular day, in his brain, he could actually extrapolate and calculate what the next day would be. So if you told him you were born on a certain day, he would know within four-year increments what day your birth date actually fell on, the day of your birth, what day. And that's kind of how he did it. And so I just wanted to throw that out there. So Professor James Fallon, He is of the Department of Psychiatry and Human Behavior and affiliated with the Department of Anatomy and Neurobiology at the School of Medicine at the University of California, Irvine. And he's the author among many books. One of them is The Psychopath Inside. And his work, he was studying brain scans of psychopaths. And lo and behold, he came across his own brain scan and saw that his brain scan looked exactly like psychopaths.
Jeez.
So he identifies himself as a pro-social psychopath. And so the case that he makes is that environmentally, you can pro-socialize someone who may have the brain scan of a psychopath. One of the scans is a lot of, you know, of low activity in the prefrontal cortex and in the hippocampus and the amygdala. And so somehow that if you can socialize that, that maybe you can mitigate the antisocial behavior of a genetic psychopath. So this leads me to this question, and I just want to say that I've done a lot of work studying the amygdala and the hippocampus, which is part of the limbic system. And so they have the amygdala in particular, as your guest knows, Mr. Slade, stores the volatility of emotional memories. It's a library of emotional memories. Some of the emotional memories are negatively charged and positively charged.
Absolutely.
Depending on the experience. Right. And then the prefrontal cortex acts as a kind of modulator to determine how to respond in the event that there's a moment of dysregulation, which would, you know, have resulted in some volatility. So that having been said, you know, when I look at trauma and I look at some of the issues dealing with trauma, such as dealing with EMDR as a remedy, you know, eye movement desensitization, I have an analogy, which is you have a patient and you tell them and they're trying to go back into their trauma. And the reason why they need to go back into the trauma is because they need to extract that emotional memory and they need to somehow lower the emotional charge of the memory stored in the amygdala.
Yes.
The way I kind of equate it is, imagine watching one of these car crash tests that you see for like NHTSA or the Department of Transportation, the Department of Insurance. But what I've always fascinated is they'll always show two references. They'll show the car smashing in at full acceleration and you don't know where the pieces are. And then when they show the car slow motion, I'm always fascinated with the car crashing in slow motion because then you see how all of the pieces just fell down and where they fell down. And that's kind of how I equate trauma work in trying to, you know, reduce the voltage, if you will, the emotional voltage of a trauma event in going back in time. That having been said, going back to Dr. Fallon and what he found in the amygdala, and it was said about diet and stuff, my question to Mr. Slade is, in any of your research and your experience, have you known of or is there any potential of maybe through neurobiology or through diet or whatever of expanding the volume size of the amygdala so that we have a more empathic person who would be predisposed to manufacturing an empathic response to any type of event?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Well, okay, a couple of things that let me touch upon, okay? First of all, the way that the amygdala works, it's independent of the frontal lobes and the executive part of the brain. It's odd, the amygdala reacts to certain cues, whether they be negative or positive. And the whole idea of the amygdala is to bypass the higher parts of the brain.
It's your escape mechanism, isn't it?
It's kind of an automatic. It provides you with in terms of negative responses, if your brain perceives something that is harmful to you, the amygdala automatically kicks in to provide you with that automatic fight or flight response.
That
and
rush.
It bypasses all of the higher functions of the brain. So it doesn't go to the frontal lobes. It doesn't ask the frontal lobes, should I react to this or not? It's independent. It will react automatically based upon its conditioning. For example, if you were a child and you saw a pretty flower on the stove and you reached up to touch the pretty blue flower, well, you got burned. And so the painful memory is registered in the amygdala so that whenever you see another pretty blue flower on a stove or something like that, you will automatically pull your hand away from that so you don't get burned. The same can be said of, now the amygdala isn't just for negative things, it also works for positive reward reinforcement. So for example, if when you are an infant, your mother smiles at you and then feeds you, you then associate a smile with positive reward. And so whenever anyone smiles at you, your reaction is to go with that person or to trust that person until you learn otherwise, until you have a traumatic memory. Now, at the brain lab, another thing you talked about was trauma memories. At the brain lab, T.D. Lingo, the director, devised a series of exercises called Trauma Drama, which had a lot in common with Janov and Primal Scream Therapy and other types of therapy. Basically, he taught people to remember, to consciously remember traumas that they had forgotten or had not thought about or had never thought about. And by reliving those traumas, you would then discover the association with some negative types of behavior or emotions that you would have. And then you could reprogram that trauma utilizing your frontal lobes and imagination. So you would reimagine the trauma as having either done correctly without the trauma or reprogramming the memory so that whenever your brain would have an association that resembled that incident that caused the trauma, you wouldn't react to that through the negative clicking backwards of the amygdala, but you would remember the more positively influenced reprogramming of that memory. And in that way, you could reprogram your brain so that that former trauma would no longer have the same influence on you and bring up the same type of negative experiences that you were trying to, you know, figure out and heal from.
Neil, and I want to ask you real quickly before the break about telepathy, inside or outside the brain, as we've been mentioning, but what do you think of it, telepathy?
Oh, I absolutely believe that it's a real thing. And I mean, I wouldn't say it's a daily occurrence around here, but both my wife and I often have communications with either between ourselves or with other people.
You could think it, and she knows your answer.
Okay, just yesterday, for example, I have a friend who's a surgeon, and I decided to write him an email. And I wrote to him, and he said, "Son of a gun, I had just typed your name into the computer, and I was going to email you when suddenly your email popped up."
That happens all the time. Neil, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back in a moment and take final phone calls. Our special guest tonight is what I would call Mr. Brain, Neil Slade. His books are all listed at his website, neilslade.com, which we have linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. So don't touch your dial. We'll get to the calls when we come right back. We're going to start open lines next hour here on Coast to Coast, so get ready for that. One of the topics, of course, I'm going to ask you is, did you almost die? Whatever happened to you? So think about that, plus full open lines on Coast to Coast. We're going to come back in a moment with Neil Slade and take final calls with him. Welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you along with Neil Slade. We're going to continue chatting with Neil and taking calls, and let's go to the phones. First-time caller Jack in New Hampshire. Welcome to the show. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Jack.
Hi, George, Neil. How you doing?
Good. Wonderful. My
question, I've had this thought, is what if we're all kind of like nodes on a universal network, if everything is in the universe is essentially energy, and our brains are kind of a portal or a sending, receiving, a lot like cloud computing, and our memories aren't actually stored on our brain, in our brains, but are stored out like in the universe, sort of like cloud computing, and we each have individual access to them for, you know, we have some kind of coded way of accessing those memories. Seems like the brain like a lot of local storage devices, just wouldn't be able to hold all those all the memories that you have.
Right. Oh, I think that's quite a good possibility. I think what happens is, having brains, most of the signals that we pay attention to are in physical reality, and they're loud, and they get our attention. And it's only when you know, this is one of the reasons why Lingo had his brain laboratory up in the wilderness, because up in the wilderness, there was a lot less static, there was less noise, there was less distractions. And so people would naturally have an enhanced ability to tune into those things that are normally kind of covered up by distractions in the city and such. So people were able to tune into information and ideas that they normally wouldn't. And it may be very well that the kind of cloud computing situation that you're talking about could very well be the reality. And there are many people who believe that's the case.
Neil, how do you explain deja vu?
Deja vu. Haven't you asked me that question before?
On another show. About a year ago.
Possibly. Very possibly. I don't know.
But that was cute. I like that.
Oh, thank you. I don't know. I don't know if anyone actually has an explanation for it. It may, people say that there's an infinite number of universes out there, that somewhere there's a planet that's just like Earth and everything is exactly the same, except that on that planet, instead of my name being Neil, it's Gary, or there's one difference. So there's an infinite number of parallel universes out there, and it may be that perhaps we are experiencing that experience on another, we're connecting with that experience on another level where it's already happened before to us. Or maybe, I mean, that seems as likely as anything. I don't know if there really is an explanation for that. I have had that experience, and many people have. Or it may be just a trick of the brain, as mm-hmm. some people claim, that it's just the illusion that we've experienced. Maybe it's a matter of we've had an experience similar enough to it that it triggers what we believe is a memory of that same event re-happening again, where in actuality only something similar to that has happened to us. So, yeah, I really don't know.
Do you believe that, let's say you look at a crowd of 100 people.
Yeah.
Obviously, you can't pick them all out. But that the brain has recorded all of them, and under hypnotherapy, you might be able to bring out everything you saw? Almost as if you take a picture of 100 people, and then you look at them, and you go, oh, here's Joe, Jim, and you know, Sally, and you have them all. But when you just think about it, you can't remember them all.
That's a possibility. As a rule, that's not the experience of most of us. But then you come across people who are savants, like we were talking about Rain Man, who can remember the contents of a phone book or an encyclopedia. And so that may be one of the dormant areas of the brain that under normal circumstances we don't have that ability to have perfect recall memory. But we do have people, and my wife is one of them, who has these extraordinary enhanced photographic types of memories. We can play a game of cards, for example, a 500 rummy, and we made my mother and I, my mother being 96, and I have been playing 500 rummy for all of our lives. Me, since I was 5 years old, she had played it all of her life with her mother. And we taught Julia, my wife from China, how to play 500 rummy, and now she wins 80% of the time. And we try to figure out, well, why is that? Why does she have this ability to win a card? And one of the things that we know about Julia is that she has this extraordinary photographic memory. So she remembers all the cards that we pick up that are laid out on the deck. So she doesn't make the mistake of putting out a card that she knows that we can use. So she's got that ability. And so some people have more ability to memorize things, and some people may very well have the ability to have that type of memory that you're talking about, which is dormant in most of us, but like Rain Man and like other savants, they do have that ability to draw upon that memory that stores all of these things. Or maybe it's a matter of it being in the cloud, like your last...
Mm-hmm. That's not a bad concept.
Yeah, and people are able to tune into that where most of us just aren't.
Mark in Baltimore, Maryland. Hello, Mark. Take it away.
Oh, so much for taking my phone call.
Thank you, sir.
And it's a terrific subject, and there's not a thing that your esteemed guest has said that I could not totally agree with. I mean,
Thank you.
He said, I was thinking to myself before the terrific questions that you were asking, what would my answer be in my life? And, I am a veteran and spent still most of my life working for the government, even though that has nothing to do with it. It's just that I'm 60, going to be 62 in August, and 2 years ago, I already knew how to meditate. So 2 years ago, I decided I want to become a musician and drift away from painting and drawing that I was always done.
Cool.
After my military service, after I went to school and all that. And so just like that, and I everything you said, I've applied to my life. So I would have to say we definitely are using more than 10% of our brains, definitely, if we can access them. And the one last thing I would just have to say, and thank you for letting me say this, is, and it could just dovetail into your next hour, I've had over 20 near-death experiences.
20, Mark? Wow.
Anytime anybody wants me to talk about them, I will talk about them.
Try to call back for open lines. I'd love to have you check in with us. Or if anything, I'll put you on hold. And I'd like to hear about this. I've never heard of somebody with 20 near-death experiences.
That's quite incredible.
That's huge.
I want to hear it.
I'll put them on hold. And let us go next to Joe in Monterey, California. Joseph, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, George. Wow, that's 20 near-death experiences.
Whoa, I know it.
He's a tour guide.
Is that good news or bad news?
I do lots of different modalities and healing work, and my clients sometimes they get very powerful healings going back to their past lives. And I can see that they go back to their past lives, and they can see how their personality is affected by their past lives. Some very directly, and there are those that are very markedly affected by their past lives. And we feel, the clients and other people that do the work, that a lot of that soul remembers a great deal. It doesn't bring everything into the physical incarnation, just enough. But we sometimes get what we call spontaneous regression, where we go back and we know that we've had a past life in a certain way, certain elements of it. How does the personality affect the brain, not just as we are taught, we learn personality from the first few years of life. We start to acquire that. But there are other aspects to it, like Shirley Temple, okay,
prodigies.
And Mozart.
Go ahead, Neil.
Yeah, well, of course, and that goes back to my student that I was talking about earlier. Where did she get this extraordinary ability to play the piano? If it was not genetic, maybe she was a musician in her previous lifetime. You have people like Mozart, who, how do you explain a Mozart? How do you even explain a Bach? Where does this talent come from? It doesn't seem to emanate solely from the personal experience in one given lifetime. It seems as though there's an external thing that's coming in either from a previous lifetime or from external forces that are outside of a personal experience. And very often these previous lifetime memories can be verified. And there's lots of examples of that kind of thing that you can find online and in documentaries, where people claim to have existed in a previous life and then give supportive evidence for such. And George, you probably have had stories like that on your show as well.
Many, many, many. Linda in Spokane, Washington's with us. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Good evening.
Hi.
And thank you for being a lighthouse for us while we traverse the seas.
I am a beacon of light for all our people.
Yes, you are. I wanted to tell you and Neil how I've discovered my amygdala dysfunction and how it never developed. A baby knows its mommy in the womb. A baby has that certain attachment and bonding. And when I was born, I was given to some adoptive parents. And because of that missing part, that grieving of not being with my birth mommy, my real mommy, my amygdala never developed. Plus, I was a baby that went through a lot of traumatic, horrific experiences. Anyways,
your amygdala did not have that ability to click forward into pleasure and frontal lobes types of things that we've been talking about. Is that what you're saying?
What causes that, though, Neil?
Well, trauma causes that. That you don't learn how to connect with those parts of your brain that provide you with satisfaction and pleasure. And I think that's what that this woman is speaking of. That it was difficult, if not impossible, to connect with those parts of the brain. Am I correct?
Well, the problem is my amygdala, since it never had a chance to develop fully, it is in that kind of controlling, quicker than lightning thinking, not always flipping backwards. I don't have the forward side of pleasure and happiness, and I can't, as far as going back and remembering the trauma part that's compartmentalized in my brain or my mind. I was told by a psychiatrist that my nervous system couldn't handle it.
Well, let me say this. I think you can handle it, and you can learn how to tickle that amygdala forward. And I want to tell people that I now provide the Frontal Lobe Supercharge book, which has all of the exercises that teach you how to click your amygdala forward and turn on your frontal lobes. It's absolutely free now. So you can go to my website and you can download the book for free, or you can go to YouTube and you can listen to the audiobook, 229 pages, absolutely free, and learn some techniques of how to get out of that reptilian backward click and how to click forward. So you can teach yourself and you can reprogram your brain how to do that. So absolutely, there's a way for you to do that, and it won't cost you a penny.
By doing it, Neil, does that make us better people? What does it do to us?
Oh, absolutely makes us better people. The frontal lobes is where all of the advanced behaviors reside in the human brain. In other words, you get out of that self-defense, counterattack, combat frame of mind, fight or flight, and you click into creativity and cooperation. You know, one of your guests was talking about the pathological, the part of the brain responsible for psychopathic behavior.
Yep.
And that little part of the brain which allows you to get out of that, which in psychopathic people is dormant or not being used enough, that's in the frontal lobes. That's in a part called the prefrontal cortex. And you absolutely can consciously learn how to activate that part of your brain. And it's as simple as turning on a light switch. There's lots of ways to do it, and they're all easy to do, and they're all scientifically based. It's not just something some crazy person is made up, but there's a scientific basis.
Well, Neil, you always do a great job for us, my friend. Thank you for being on the program. Neil's website, his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, open lines plus a question. How many deaths have you had, or how close did you come to dying?